Hi, and welcome to another edition of the Autoblog Podcast. This is the 28th episode. I'm John Neff.
And I'm Chris Paukert.
And we are here, as we always are, almost every week. I'd probably say, what, every 2 weeks, maybe?
We do what we can, John.
We do. It's been a busy month for us, at least. There's a lot going on at Autoblog. Of course, the site takes a lot of effort to keep going, but there's a lot of cool stuff going on behind the scenes, too, that everyone will be privy to in a few weeks. So stay tuned to autoblog.com to watch what happens next with our little site, little corner of the internet.
That's right, and we're gearing up for New York as well.
Yes, the New York Auto Show, which is next week already, which came out of nowhere. And it's going to be fun because it's the last show of the season, kind of. I mean, during the summer, there really aren't any large, you know, manufacturer-supported auto shows. Not until, I think, L.A. probably. And when's that? No, that's November.
Yeah, that's a little bit later.
So what, SEMA's November, Paris, September. That might be
Gay Paris.
Paris. So we'll actually be attending that one, too. I think you're going to go over, and I'm going to go over to Paris.
That's the plan, if they let me out of the country.
If they do.
Or let me into the country. You know, there's that, too.
You're going to get stuck in a plane over international waters, and they're not going to land.
I tell you, with the luck I've been having with airlines lately, that would be par for the course.
Well, you know what? Maybe we'll get a media vehicle and drive to Paris. That'll be better. Mm. So today on the show, we have a few good tidbits of news to go over, all stuff that's appeared on autoblog.com. First, today, the Audi TT was unveiled, so we're going to go over some details of the new TT, the Bauhaus Coupe. And also, we're going to pay our last respects to one of our print mags in the industry that has gone under, I guess. And there's no easy way to put it.
No. Very quickly, I might add. It wasn't around long enough.
Right, it wasn't. And it came out of nowhere. And then finally, we're going to talk about the Jetta, the Volkswagen Jetta I got to drive and kind of, I guess, do a little mini in the Autoblog garage review for that runs on straight vegetable oil. It's a Jetta TDI from 2003 that was converted to run on straight vegetable oil. So I'll talk about that because it was a really, really interesting day for me. And I put one post up. I plan to put another one up on the website about what happened that day. So we're going to talk about that as well. But before we begin, as always, I want to give Volvo a chance to say their piece.
For 50 years, Volvo has been selling safety-conscious vehicles in America. To celebrate, we have special offers on every Volvo in our current model lineup. And they all come equipped with legendary Volvo safety. Visit www.volvocars.us or see your local Volvo retailer for more information.
Okay, and we're back, and we're going to kick things off by starting with the Audi TT. What is this, 2007 Audi TT, I assume?
I believe it is 2007. Yeah, and it's hard to update something that's as iconic as this design.
Well, and that's what I was going to bring that up too. When you bring out a new car and really hit the ball out of the park, you know, your first at bat, that's kind of a problem. You know, you stick with that design for as long as you can because it's going to be really hard to top it the second time around. And that's kind of how I feel with this new TT.
Yeah, I mean, it's very clearly an evolutionary design. I mean, it's definitely a bit bigger all the way around. It's 5 inches longer and 3 inches wider. The wider makes sense, I think, from a performance standpoint, and the longer overhangs maybe to eke out a little bit more storage capacity. But I think more than that, it's probably for pedestrian safety regulation compliance, which is too bad and kind of mucks around with the proportions of these vehicles.
Yeah, it's definitely cut from the same like form as the original. But I mean, what do you think? Is the original better looking, or is this?
Yeah, you know, I mean, When the original came out, I really, for whatever reason, just gravitated toward that vehicle. And I think in terms of design, it's arguably the most cohesive inside and out of the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, I completely agree.
And I mean, it's a, I call them design-cons. I don't know if anybody else has ever used the term.
You should
like
patent that. That's awesome.
Well, I've looked at that, and the spelling is something that just doesn't work. So
is it design-cons with a Z? Because every cool marketing buzzword has a Z in it.
No, I stay away from the Z.
Okay.
But at any rate, it's really, really hard to update an icon. And I think they've done a nice job. I think in the press photos, it looks good. I can't wait to see it in the flesh because often cars have completely different, impressions that way. The overhangs, especially in the front, are maybe a tiny little bit off-putting, I think, especially around the headlights when viewed in profile. The fender blisters look a little bit strange, but I do think it looks good.
You know, with the overhangs, it's the same issue with the Audi A4. I liked the previous version Audi A4 a little more because of its kind of stubby nature and the proportion it had because mm-hmm. of the short overhangs. And this kind of has turned the cars into, I guess, more visual than anything, but a much longer, thinner looking car, even though they've grown wider. They just haven't grown as wide as they've grown long. But it's interesting. I also gravitated towards the original one. I think it's an instant icon. I mean, when it came out, people were just awed at a piece of art that could be mass produced like that.
Yep.
And even though it was never lauded as the best performing, sports coupe for the money, you couldn't argue with its style at all.
No, and the performance, you know, they really stuck with it over time. And, you know, when they brought out the DSG gearbox and everything, it really upped the ante to the point where I think it did a pretty good job of disguising its humble roots. I really like that vehicle and actually have been considering purchasing a used one, mm-hmm. Especially if I can find a nice early silver one without the little ducktail spoiler.
Yeah. Good luck.
I might have to break out the hacksaw and lose the hat and smooth it down. And I really hope they bring back the baseball glove leather. I really thought that was cool.
Yeah, very. Although, you know, you look at the front of the new Audi TT, and the first thing I noticed was it had angry eye headlights.
Yeah.
Which is like the thing now. You have to have your car have a scowl, have this kind of angry look. And I think Eric did a post on it. You know, that like the first vehicle that had that was the current Chevy Silverado, which took it a little too far.
It took it much too far. And I don't know that that was the first, but it was a pretty clear indication of what was going on.
Yeah.
And I think in general, without getting sidetracked, you've seen a lot more. I mean, I did an editorial on this a couple of years ago almost on the boxy trend of vehicles. And I think that that's part of it. It's more aggressive and less, you know, smooth and round form.
So we should probably go over a little bit of the specs, like what engines are available. Audi says two drivetrains are going to be available at the launch. One's going to be a 2-liter, 200 horsepower direct injection turbo 4-cylinder, or you can get the Quattro all-wheel drive model that comes standard with a 3.2-liter V6 making 250 horsepower. And of course, I think the DSG 6-speed is available on both, I believe, if I'm reading that correctly.
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I think that sounds right. It comes standard with a 6-speed and then optional with the dual clutch.
The body is a combination of steel panels as well as aluminum. Strategically placed to balance out the weight distribution, which is mm-hmm. good. That's always appreciated.
Well, as is the powered spoiler, which does away with the aforementioned problematic little ducktail that they drafted on when they were having some aerodynamic handling issues.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, they never truly admitted that it had a problem. They just appeased the people who were arguing it did.
Yeah, they just added the stability control or reined it in a little bit and mm-hmm. took out some of the, I guess, the rear end swapping handling, which I think is fun, but for some reason everybody else doesn't like.
So today, I guess it was unveiled in Berlin today, and Stuart watched the whole thing on the webcast, which I guess it was hours long and very tedious. The first part of this kind of debut was some type of German celebration of innovation, and we didn't even notice.
Vorsprung durch Technik.
Exactly. We didn't even notice this until we looked at Stuart's post of pictures that were lifted from this webcast, and they unveiled this sculpture of the new Audi TT. And at first, you look at these pictures, and you're like, big whoop, it looks like a stainless steel Audi TT. But then you read about this sculpture, and it's a supersized sculpture.
Yeah, there's one good picture of it being unveiled where the guy is not even up to the windowsill.
Yeah,
that's pulling it back.
10 meters long. So about, 30 feet long, and weighs 10 tons. Unbelievable. You have to go to this post and look at this picture. And I'm going to put this on dig.com because they'll go crazy for this. It's just a giant – it doesn't even look like a good sculpture. Like, it doesn't even look extremely detailed.
Yeah.
I don't know why modern sculptors can't, like, do what sculptors did
I bet they can, but you know, this thing has pretty minimalistic lines to it, and it may be, you know, that our grainy little resolution isn't really doing it justice either.
Maybe. You know what? The front tire looks both tires kind of look a little flat. Looks like they're low on air. I should check that out. So they unveiled it. It's out. No word on pricing. A Roadster is going to follow. We'll probably see that in Paris first, or at an auto show later this year.
Where's the S version? That's what I want to know.
Oh, it'll be on its way, I'm sure. That'll be extremely exciting. I would get one of these cars for the DSG transmissions alone. Those things are outstanding feats of engineering.
Yep.
But yeah, I have to say, I'm not like super excited that it's out. I think they did a great job of kind of eking this reveal and getting the most play they could out of publicity. I mean, I truly do think that Audi plants spy shots. You know, they plant vehicles around where people, they know people are going to be. I think they're in control of all that, and they eke information out on their own terms. So the buildup's been so long that, I mean, I can't get too excited that it's here, but it's nice.
Well, you're right. I mean, it feels like we've already seen all of these shots at one point or another. Just, you know, if you add up all the different little pastiche cover of shots that we've seen, you know, of all the spy covered mules running around. And it feels like we've already seen this car.
Yeah. George Acorn from Fortitude.com wrote a good little article on how he analyzed every piece of information that's come out for the Audi TT in the past 6 months. If you look at it in succession, it's obvious Audi was behind them all. I mean, there wasn't one spy shot that was taken that Audi didn't deliberately drive the car with, you know, a stick of electrical tape over the Audi symbol, you know, past a spy photographer, you know. So I think they know exactly what they're doing, and they got a lot of, they got tons of play out of it, you know, a lot of airtime on the internet, so to speak. So yeah, it just means we're not too excited about it because we've had almost our fill of it, but I'm sure people seeing it for the first time are probably pretty surprised. It's a good looking vehicle. Evolutionary.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing it in the flesh, which I believe we'll see it in New York.
I hope so.
I have to say, and I've harped on this before with other vehicles, but I have no idea where you're going to put American license plates on this car, especially on the back. It doesn't fit. So I'm wondering if we get a different trunk lid or a different bumper. But if you look
at the back end, it
simply doesn't fit.
Yeah. Well, even on the
front, you can get away with it, it's ugly, but it does fit. But the back end, I'm just not exactly sure what happens there.
It's not even the United States. It's we both live in Ohio where we have to put our license plates on both the front and back, which totally stinks. I mean, most cars make a slot, unlike the Audi TT we're looking at here, but most cars make a slot for the license plate in the back, but many, you know, don't for the front because there aren't – every state doesn't require a front license plate.
Mm-hmm.
But – we have to live in one that does, which totally stinks. So
we should stick it to the man.
We should make a petition or something. Okay, but anyway, let's move on to the next story, which involves MPH Magazine. News came out this week, just a couple days ago, or yesterday even maybe, that MPH has basically closed its doors. It's a magazine that hasn't been around a super long time. I think less than a year.
Yeah, I want to say since September, if I'm not mistaken.
September.
Yeah, so really short period of time.
No, you know what? I think it was around earlier than September 2005. Yeah, yeah, it had to be around for at least a year. And, you know, for any of you who haven't picked up a copy of MPH, it was, you know, a car rag in the tradition of a European magazine. I mean, extremely sarcastic. Babes everywhere.
I would say in terms of if you're going there, I would say it's European in the non-British sense, or in the more along the lines of what's the big tuner rag that's over
Max
there?
Max Power.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It is a little Max Powery. I think the writing is definitely irreverent, or was irreverent,
mm-hmm.
And fun, but it definitely had that versus with a little mixed in Maxim or something along those lines.
Well, and you know what? Its level of humor was much higher and a different kind of humor than traditional American mags. I mean, we put so much emphasis on this, like, you know, writing the perfect essay about a car. And I think we're, in general, a lot more lenient with cars that maybe don't deserve any praise. You know, we try and find the nice in everything. Where I think, you know, the European style of car review is brutal. It's honest, you know.
Speak for yourself. I'm a bastard.
But I think, I mean, in general, you look at the top four car magazines that are still in print, that everybody's buying, Motor Trend and Car and Drive and all them. And, you know, I think for the most part, their relationship with the automakers is so intimate that they know that it's probably not a good thing to go off on a car that doesn't so obviously deserve it. You know, the Aztec you can go off on, you know, what can GM say? I mean, but, you know, if there's a car that, you know, isn't that great a car, but, you know, half the time they're not going to totally go off on it. Maybe give the automaker what it deserves and shake them up a little. But MPH kind of did that. They went after cars, whatever they felt kind of deserved a thrashing or... So anyway, their doors are closed. They have gone out of business, I guess. And we assume, you know, they started from the beginning as right from the first issue, doing everything right, which is commendable, but it's also very expensive. So we can see how if you're going to put out, you know, a magazine in perfect binding and you're going to have that type of photography, that type of layout, those kind of stories, that you're paying top dollar from the get-go, and it's hard to kind of bring the advertising up to speed to pay for that in the long term. Get your subscriptions up. So I think it's unfortunate. I think they were a very unique choice. It was my choice for a magazine on an airplane all the time. I'd pick that one.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
I actually, you know, I reluctantly kind of caved and got a subscription, I think maybe a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. It was a love or hate proposition with me. I appreciated the fact that they were trying to do something different and that they were pretty snarky and mm-hmm. and were willing to be critical. But sometimes I got the feeling I was reading a Maxim and it was kind of a guilty pleasure sort of thing. But
I agree. Yeah, it was a guilty pleasure, I think, is a good term for it. Not many people know this, but one of the employees of MPH was our own David Thomas, who used to be the editor for Autoblog back when I was just reading it. I wasn't even working for Autoblog. And he actually left Autoblog and ended up doing a lot of online stuff for MPH. So David is a great guy and a great writer. I hope I wish him well and hope he ends up in a good spot after this. He posted on our a comment on the post that we did about MPH going under. And I don't know, he seems to imply that you may not have heard the last of either him or MPH. I don't know. It was kind of a very vague.
Yeah. Well, post. I mean, you never know. I mean, it could be reborn as something, or American Media, AMI, you know, might sell off the name or somehow look to, you know, revamp it.
Well, and, you know, credit should be given to Dave because they had a very good online presence. They had a lot of spy shots before anybody did, a lot of good stuff. And, I mean, I think he took a lot of what he learned at Autoblog and applied it over there, and it worked for them. So who knows? Maybe they'll go on as a web portal.
Could be.
And Prince, I mean,
it seems to be a way a lot of things are going these days.
Well, one could argue that maybe MPH isn't around here anymore because of all of us on the internet. You know, maybe they're a casualty of the times. But
we're becoming the man.
I hope not. I mean, I still get all my car magazines. I mean, I like getting my stuff on the internet, but there's something about getting a car magazine, just like going to the movies. You know. I could.
Yeah,
sure,
I believe in the romance of the printed word. I really do.
Yeah, exactly. I believe in the experience of it, the opening of the mailbox, the excitement of getting a car magazine and cracking it open. You know, it's, you know, I could download my movies on the internet for free, but I like going to see them in the theater every once in a while because it's a theater and I can get popcorn there. So that's my argument. If any of that made sense.
Yeah, you just want the milk duds.
All right. Anyway, so we wish everyone who's at MPH good luck wherever they end up. It's a crowded market and it's pretty tough out there, but, hey, if any of you guys want to post, give me a call. I'm always looking for good writers. All right.
Sell it.
So the last thing we're going to talk about is my time a couple weeks ago with a guy named Chuck Norton, who lives around Cleveland, and I found him through the grapevine. He and his brother are the owner of a 2003 Jetta SVO, stands
the
for
VegaJet.
The VegaJet, if you will.
Or the VegaJet, depending on how you read it.
And basically, for those who don't know, an SVO vehicle is a diesel vehicle that has been converted to also run on straight vegetable oil. Also can run on waste vegetable oil, or WVO, but that doesn't roll off the tongue as much, so I call it SVO.
Don't confuse the Ford lovers.
Yeah, exactly. It's not. It makes it sound like it's a performance car, but they're decidedly not performance oriented. So basically, I spent kind of the day with Chuck in his car, and he explained to me, you know, what it's like to own a car that runs off of vegetable oil. And you know, the biggest difference is that you can drive your SVO vehicle to the local China buffet and go in and ask the manager if you can go out back and take some of his grease that's been sitting in his grease dumpster. And this is the whole idea, is that straight vegetable oil, peanut oil, canola oil, cotton oil, and, you know, any kind of vegetable oil. And you can go back there, load up a barrel of the grease, take it home, filter it through these little kind of like a cloth filters to get, you know, the chunks of perch and potato out of them.
That's
what's in them. He showed me. You got to get the chunks out. So you filter it and you put it.
I don't know about needing to de-chunk my fuel, John.
It's a small price to pay for.
I'm a lazy American. I like
stability.
To just plug the hole in the, you know, and there you go.
put the nozzle in the pump and squeeze
right.
the trigger. But it was really interesting because you know once you get it home, you store it. You kind of keep it heated, because. Of course, with vegetable oil, the colder it gets, the more viscous it gets, the more thick, almost to the point of not even being able to flow. So you want to keep it warm when you're either transferring it into the vehicle, and this is kind of the catcher. An SVO vehicle has a completely separate fuel system for the vegetable oil, which includes a separate fuel tank. Now, when you put the vegetable oil in the car, when you start up the vehicle, it can't run on the vegetable oil right away because that has to warm up and thin out so it can run through the fuel line. So any SVO vehicle is going to have both its diesel fuel system still intact and the separate SVO fuel system. And for the first 5 minutes of any trip, you're going to be running off of the diesel. And that's going to warm the engine up, warm the coolant up. And part of the whole trick is the coolant system is kind of replumbed to go follow the fuel line of the SVO, of the vegetable oil, back to the SVO tank. And the idea is that as soon as the coolant warms up, it warms up the SVO fuel line and warms up the tank of SVO fuel. And that all together only takes about 5 minutes.
There's a lot going on in 5 minutes. The McDonald's hybrid is what it sounds like.
Yeah, although they warned me, you don't want to go to a chain restaurant because that's the really bad oil. Family-owned restaurants. And they literally said for some reason, China buffets. You know, Asian food, they said Asian restaurants have the best oil. They had no explanation, but these are guys.
It's the extra fish heads are good for a couple of extra octanes. Or so, I don't know.
It's funny because I talked with Chuck Norton, the owner of the car, and he showed me his whole setup at their workplace, how they fill it and all this stuff. And I got to drive it over to Full Circle Fuels in Oberlin, Ohio. And that's the company that did the conversion. And driving it is, I mean, there's no difference driving it versus a diesel.
Yeah, if you're not behind you.
Well, you know, everybody said it smelled. I didn't smell anything in the car. I don't have the nose of a bloodhound, but I hardly smelled anything inside the car. Maybe it did smell behind me. I don't know. It wasn't following me. But in terms of power, you know, it was acted just like a diesel. It was torquey like a diesel, but wasn't snappy, kind of. Everything else reacted the same, except, you know, you do have this extra fuel tank filled with fuel, so the handling feels like you have something large attached to your back when you're trying to turn and stop. So I made it to the Full Circle Fuel place and sat down and talked with a guy and who does this stuff. The two guys who own that particular place, Sam Merritt and Bob Beckett, and two young guys. The place is a converted gas station, ironically, and they're having a ball. They're converting vehicles left and right now. I mean, it's really something that's speeding up, and I was really interested.
How many do they do a year, do you know?
Well, I asked them how long it takes, and they usually said about a week. They said it only takes like a day or two to do the conversion, but they usually drive it around for a day or two and make sure that the engine's all right, do the conversion, and drive it around for some more to make sure that the conversion, like, you know, took and there's not any bugs in the system. So they could probably do one or two a week, I would imagine. When I was there, they had a 1995 Mercedes E-Class that they were converting. They had a brand new Jeep Liberty CRD they were converting, and another Volkswagen New Beetle that they were doing a conversion on. And they're all custom conversions. Like, all of them are a little different.
I was wondering about, and maybe you can answer this, about some of the engine programming. Mm-hmm. Do they have to tinker with that? They must have to do something with it.
No, nothing.
Really?
No. And maybe it's the mechanics of a diesel engine compared to a gasoline, because I would, you know, if you tinker with a gasoline engine, you would have to consider that. And I wouldn't be the one to ask. We should get Eric on to talk about this. But it really takes just like – you don't have to modify the engine at all. You have to modify the fuel system. It's all about the viscosity of the vegetable oil and it causing problems in the engine.
It's all about the fish heads.
Exactly. Once it's warmed up and thin, it's totally fine. But for about 8 inches – the SVO fuel line and the diesel fuel line are sharing a line, and that 8 inches of line is like the kicker. You have to, when you're done with the trip, like for the day, for the last 5 minutes of your trip, you have to switch it back to diesel, and you have to flush out that shared line of vegetable oil, because if anything is left in there or left in the injectors or the cylinders, it'll just congeal and it'll cause huge problems. So, I mean, that's basically the change you have to make to your driving habit, is to remember to start with diesel and to finish your ride with diesel. But everything else in between could be straight vegetable oil. And the idea is, assuming that this doesn't become a nationwide phenomenon, most of the time you can get your fuel from restaurants like this. And you get it for free. So you're paying for a little bit of diesel you use at the beginning and the end of a trip. And, you know, I was talking to Chuck Norton and asking him what kind of mileage he gets. And he said on straight vegetable oil, it's this pretty much the same as diesel, you know, maybe like 45 miles to gallon with, you know, maybe mostly highway driving. But he said, I don't pay for that. So really for what I'm paying for, I'm getting like 145 miles per gallon on the diesel.
Mm-hmm. And what's the conversion cost of these approximately?
They are about $2,000 to $3,000. I think they start a little
under. See, there you're
two.
Paying for it right there.
Yeah, but you look at it in terms of like a hybrid, and everyone says you never make your money back in a hybrid, or it takes 100 to 200,000 miles to make your money back in a hybrid. If you get one of these and you are getting your fuel from, like, let's say a restaurant for free, mm-hmm. the money you're saving on fuel could literally pay for the conversion in a year or two. So, I mean, and then it could start paying for the car, for Christ's sake, you know? Assuming, mm-hmm. like I said, assuming this doesn't become a huge thing and everybody try, you know,
I don't see
pulling up at restaurants, but
yeah, no, I don't see that happening. I don't think there are going to be rows and rows of dumpster divers out there with nice big gloves on.
Well, in terms of people who are trying to think creative, in terms of alternative fuels and what we're going to do in the future, I mean, imagine the whole problem with some of these alternative fuels is infrastructure. There is no infrastructure for distributing hydrogen, and that's a huge problem. And ethanol is in like, you know, 2% of the pumps. I don't know if that's the real number, but you know,
I think that's optimistic.
Yeah, exactly. Think of, if you're creative, think of something where you have restaurants that sign deals with, you know, fuel companies to say, all right, well, you're producing this. Why don't we have a pump on site that can literally pump filtered vegetable oil, waste vegetable oil into cars? So you pull mm-hmm. up in the drive-thru, get a, you know, quarter pounder with cheese and a tank of gas, and you're good to go. And then they can start charging.
You know where I could see them really cornering the market is if there's like a Chinese drive-through or a Chinese chain that does delivery.
Uh-huh.
They could be like a little self-sustaining system here. Why not?
Run off the
you know,
exactly.
But I think it does, you know, open the question to biodiesel and things like that, and looking at other alternatives to, or at least intermediate solutions to the hydrogen problem.
Well, what these guys are really excited about is later this year, when ultra low sulfur diesel fuel becomes the mandatory fuel in the country. You know, they're which is awesome. I'm excited about this too.
Yeah, it should really open the floodgates for diesel here.
Exactly, and you have all these companies that are poised to just unleash diesels on the U.S. And the more diesels there are in the market, these guys are excited, because that just means the more diesels there are, the more potential conversions there are. But yeah, I mean, any of these diesels these new diesels that will come, let's say from Daimler Chrysler, and their what's they're called? Is there's Blue Tech? Yeah, Blue Tech diesels. You know, they can run biodiesel without any modification whatsoever.
And
you know, so biodiesel might become. And the real question is, when you take the sulfur out of the diesel, the sulfur is the lubricant in the fuel, in diesel fuel, but it's also the most polluting part of it. You take mm-hmm. that out, and you still need to put a lubricant in. And a lot of people are saying, since the government really isn't giving any indication as to what sulfur should be replaced with, a lot of people are looking at biodiesel. Now, because biodiesel, the vegetable oil that biodiesel comes from, is just pure lubricant. I mean, that's why if you're running vegetable oil in your diesel, it's extremely good for it. Just mm-hmm. a natural lubricant the whole time. So it was a very interesting day. I totally enjoyed it, and I learned a lot. And like I said, I have another post I want to do on it, but on kind of the company that's doing these conversions. They used to be called Griesel. Now they're called Golden Fuel System. So,
because Golden Arches Fuel Systems was
yeah, well, you know, a marketer got in there and said Griesel. Who the hell came up with that? Some stupid hippie. Good. So yeah, so they took the hippie name off it and put something more market friendly on it.
Yeah, I just picture like an otter covered in oil when you say that. It's not good.
Griesel, yeah,
yeah.
So we shall see. Like I said, I'm really excited for October. When this fuel starts coming and diesels gain in market share, like I think they deserve to, the whole argument that you know diesels have a bad name from the 80s and the horrible GM diesels, that's true, but you know the technology is sound and it's proven over in Europe and it deserves.
Oh yeah, it's oh, I think around or over 50% of new car sales over there.
Exactly, and you know what, that ratio should be the case over here. And it's not for a lot of stupid reasons, image reasons. So I hope to see that change quickly. I think hybrids are great, but I also think that diesels deserve kind of the popularity push.
A much bigger percentage of the market share, yeah. Exactly. Absolutely.
Exactly. While we're all waiting for our hydrogen fuel cell vehicles to arrive.
I've got mine on order, but I expect to be waiting a little while.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm going to wait and maybe get the second generation of hydrogens. I don't want a Hindenburg on my hands.
Aha. Uh-huh. Lovely. Let's propagate that Hindenburg myth. no, well, actually, I did want to compliment you on your first post with the SVO Jetta, because I think it looked really good, and you took some nice photographs. And
that's my new camera. I got a new camera.
Yeah. Hey, hot stuff, man.
Spent the big bucks. I got an SLR. Tried it out on Chuck's Jetta, and it worked great.
There you go. Nothing like a 2003 Jetta to break in the SLR.
Right, yeah. Don't thank me. The pictures weren't good because I learned something new about cameras. I just got a camera with a better auto setting, that's all. So we'll put that camera to test, though, in New York and see how it survives.
Yeah. Well, anyway, nice job.
Thank you, sir. On that note, we're going to bring this podcast to a close. Before we give our closing remarks, I will let Volvo say a few words again.
For 50 years, Volvo has been selling safety-conscious vehicles in America. To celebrate, we have special offers on every Volvo in our current model lineup. And they all come equipped with legendary Volvo safety. Visit www.volvocars.us or see your local Volvo retailer for more information.
Okay, we're back, and we're going to end it, so don't get too excited that we're back.
we're back.
Now that we're leaving. But we want to thank everybody for listening and remind everyone that they can get the podcast at the iTunes Music Store. Just do a search for Autoblog, and you should find us. And we would appreciate it if you subscribe. And like we said, we try to get them out every week or so. We do our best. And also, please, everyone, visit autoblog.com as well, where we have posts going up literally every hour or half hour or as often as we can make them happen.
And I imagine, too, that if you've listened to us all the way through, rambling on and on, we're probably preaching to the choir at this point. But we do appreciate you tuning in.
Exactly. We're probably not talking to new listeners right now. So for all the old listeners out there, thank you. And on that note, we're going to go out, and we will probably talk to you guys next when we're at the New York Auto Show. We're going to try and do a podcast while we're there and kind of get impressions from the floor. So
live
until
from
then,
New York, it's Autoblog night.
It's autoblog.com. Okay, so until then, we will talk to you later.
Peace out.